our penultimate seminar. Keep saying that. Next week, Carlo Massarella, and then that's it, then it's holiday time. But delighted to welcome back, I have to say, Professor Steve Fuller from Warwick University, Auguste Comte Professor of Social Epistemology. You may be a bit hazy on social epistemology, but you're certainly not hazy on Auguste Comte, father of positivism. So Steve is, well, he's a friend of the course. Steve's been doing a seminar for many years. Almost 20 years, which is fantastic. And in fact, as I know Steve from before then, because we studied philosophy of science together, so that's quite a long time now. That's probably 30 years.
More than 30 years.
More than 30 years.
I don't know. Only my parents I know for that long.
It's like Mark Twain, when he was asked about the aging process, he said, it's a matter of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. So that's where me and Steve are. Steve, as you already know, is American, United States of America. God bless America. He is a New Yorker to boot. He studied at Cambridge, he studied at Pittsburgh, he studied at Columbia. He's been senior academic professor at University of Durham before taking this chair at Warwick. And your thought
Warwick,
about
yeah.
Steve is there's a sense here of a person who's been struggling with how does philosophy, how does the sociology of science, how does it relate? What makes it important? In what sense is an academic a person of any value? Of course, as a teacher, as a researcher, but in what sense does what an academic say have any kind of relevance? And that's important for us because you're kind of quasi-academics. You're a transition from the academic world to a vocational world where science communication is meant to, we hope, have value, make the world a better place to live. So Steve is going to really talk about his field, but he's going to talk about why science communication is important. He will also talk about history of this, and that will bring us back to some of these people we've been discussing the last 8 weeks in relation to philosophy of science. So thank you, Steve, for coming here, and look forward to hearing what you're going to say.
Okay, well, so the first thing is, I'm glad to see there's so many people on this course, because this is such an important area to go into in the future, especially if you're concerned about the future of science. And I guess the first point that I want to make, because you've gone through some of this history, if you look at people like the logical positivists or Popper or Kuhn or people from the sociology of scientific knowledge like David Bloor, Barry Barnes, one of the things that all these people have in common is they actually moved disciplines in order to do something significant. All of them did. Okay? And I'm kind of similar in this regard too, and I guess you are as well. Yes. So that you start one place and you end up somewhere else, but there is a general concern about the future of science and the value of science, and there's a sense in which you really can't pursue that just operating within the normal confines of the disciplines of science in which one might be trained in. And so you have to move elsewhere, okay? And just sort of review, I'm going to start by reviewing a few things, which you may have already said to them, but maybe not. So if you look at the logical positivists, for example, you've all heard something about those guys. Those guys are often considered sort of the received view in the philosophy of science, and they have this very sort of physics-based view of science that is basically a deductive structure that science aims at ultimate laws, and there's a sense in which we want to have a kind of unified, coherent picture of how the world operates. And those guys, for the most part, were forced to do their PhDs in philosophy because physics wasn't allowing it. So these are people, Carnap, Reichenbach, I don't know how many of you these guys you've heard about, but the logical positivists, for the most part, were physicists who were very impressed by guys like Einstein and the stuff going on in the quantum world, but they couldn't actually do a PhD in physics because, in a sense, what those people like Einstein was doing wasn't seen to be normal, typical physics. It was seen as this theoretical stuff at a very kind of high, abstract level, etc. But what the logical positivists realized was that, in fact, this was what made physics meaningful to people outside of physics. And so they got their PhDs in philosophy, even though their initial degrees were in physics, because the philosophers were willing to sort of take this seriously. At least some of them were. Okay? I think this has been a problem throughout the 20th century, you might say, that the disciplinary specialization of science, right, ends up undermining the reason or the meaning why one might think science is valuable for society. And so in a sense, if you actually want to pursue that part of the issue, you have to leave science. Okay? I mean, and I do think this is a story that already begins with the logical positivists who are getting their PhDs, you know, around the time of World War I. So already disciplinary specialization is a big deal then. Okay? Now, let's say we move forward a little bit in time and we get one of the perhaps the most important contemporary of the logical positivists who had influence certainly in this country when he moved here, Karl Popper. You've run across Karl Popper. Karl Popper's PhD is in educational psychology. It is neither in physics nor philosophy. It's educational psychology. And he, in fact, studied under the leading developmental psychologist in Vienna at the time. This guy, his name is Karl Bueller. He's still, I think, a very interesting figure. He was kind of Freud's great rival in Vienna. So this is, we're talking about the 1920s, right? And so if you think about what Vienna looks like in the 1920s, first of all, it's seen as a very important kind of intellectual center after World War I. But Freud, this is where Freud really comes into his own. But he has a private practice and clinics and institutes which are privately oriented and are outside the university structure. But inside the university structure, the University of Vienna, is Karl Bueller. And he's also someone concerned about children and development, you know, just like Freud is, if you think about Oedipus complex and all these things that Freud's associated with, right? Our personalities are formed early on in the early period, first 5 years maybe. Bueller has a kind of competing theory, you might say, that's a much more cognitively oriented one. One that I think, are you familiar with Piaget? Have you heard of him? Jean Piaget? Similar to that, kind of cognitive-based view of child development. Popper did his PhD under this guy, Bueller, okay? And why? Well, because Popper thought that, in fact, what we do as we develop as human beings, just generally from the childlike stage, is that we become more and more scientific over time. And again, it's very similar to what Piaget believed as well, okay? So in other words, science isn't understood as some kind of disciplinary specialty in somebody like Popper, but is understood as a sort of general, mature worldview that everyone should adopt. And in fact, it might be the kind of ultimate stage of some kind of maturation process of the human organism. And so it's at this point I want to say, perhaps the only time in this talk, something positive about Richard Dawkins. Because Richard Dawkins, whatever else you want to say about this man, and I realize that at a certain level he's a kind of public relations disaster for science because he creates all kinds of antagonisms that people might feel are not necessary. But nevertheless, I think there is one aspect of his thinking that I think is something that Popper shared. And that is this idea that, you know, when you really take science on board as part of your worldview, in other words, science isn't just a career you enter into, but in some sense needs to be integrated into the common sense, ordinary ways in which we see the world, then you start to think about the world differently, and certain things that you might have believed, you would not believe. You'd start to become critical or skeptical or something like that. And I think that is very, you know, whatever else one wants to say about Dawkins, I think he's definitely, you know, he's got that. Okay? I think there are other things. I mean, for me, the problematic feature of Dawkins is the dogmatic adherence to a certain kind of Darwinism. So, in other words, it's his positive views that are the problem. But his general kind of critical attitude toward taken-for-granted views, right, that I think is something he very much shares with Popper, and I think a lot of these people, like Bueller, who in the early days of developmental psychology were basically imagining that the scientific attitude, the scientific mindset, where one is, you know, skeptical and critical of taken for granted assumptions, you know, Popper talks about falsifying your hypotheses, that this was a sign of intellectual maturation. Okay? And I'm on board with all this, okay? I have no problem with any of this. My problem with Dawkins is I think that he, as it were, protects Darwinism from this. So he advances the idea that one should be skeptical and critical of taken for granted views, but then he protects Darwinism from this kind of treatment, right? So there's a sense in which he's got it almost, you know, as a kind of religious thing, but that's another kind of matter. But the point is, I do think that a lot of these people who really believed in the positive view about science, and that science is something that everyone should have and everybody should know about, is because of this kind of intellectual openness, this ability to recognize error, to correct oneself in the face of error, all this kind of stuff. Anti-dogmatism. Okay? So this is very much prevalent, you know, in the 20th century views. And that's why a lot of these people, in a sense, were forced to leave science or the particular disciplines they were in, because they sort of felt that science as a discipline did not live up to its own normative standards. Science did not live up to its own hype. Science was not sufficiently critical. Science was not sufficiently open to other possibilities. Science rather became a kind of consensually oriented activity, very much like the kinds of things that science was supposed to be against, like religion or politics or whatever. Okay? And I think this is very much a theme that you will see, you know, in the course of the history of philosophy of science in the 20th century. So now you move then to somebody like Thomas Kuhn, who's normally seen as kind of an opponent of both the positivists and Popper and all of Popper's people. Of course, at the level of intellectual content, there's opposition, clearly. But if you look at the way in which Kuhn comes into the history and philosophy of science, it's really not so different from the way in which the logical positivists and the Popper and his followers went into it. They start off in science or some other non-philosophical field and end up finding themselves there. And in Kuhn's case, of course, Kuhn was trained as a physicist. And in fact, he was trained by a very important physicist at Harvard, a guy who, in 1977, I think, got the Nobel Prize in physics. Okay, and basically because he was the guy who figured out the physics that you need to know in order to jam radar signals, which is what Kuhn was doing, right, in East Anglia for the Allies during World War II. So Kuhn's doing his PhD during World War II. Part of that time, of course, he is, you know, sent off to fight the war, World War II, and he is here, and he is jamming radar signals. And one of the things that Kuhn recognizes very soon after the war is over is that the character of science is changing massively. And so the reasons why he went into science are no longer the reasons why he might want to remain in science. Okay? And I think if you want to have a poster boy for that kind of awareness, it's Kuhn. Okay? Kuhn, as an undergraduate, you can go to the Harvard archives and you can look at what he studied, and he was very much involved with the kind of college activities as a Harvard undergraduate. And, you know, it's pretty clear, you know, Kuhn's taking courses in philosophy and other fields, even though he is formerly a physics major, and he goes on and he does his PhD in physics. But he's quite clearly interested in physics because he sees physics as providing a kind of more rigorous way of addressing the fundamental philosophical problems, right, that go back to the ancient Greeks and all the rest of it, you know, nature of matter, you know, how is the universe composed, what holds it all together, all this kind of stuff. And of course, you know, being a creature of the 20th century, he's incredibly impressed by people like Einstein and the quantum mechanics people and all this kind of stuff. And so he really thinks we're getting to a point, right, where we're really getting to some fundamental views that really get us to a kind of deep understanding, an understanding that gets us far away from common sense and, you know, really gets to the basis of things. And that's why he went into physics. But what he finds out with World War II And I think this is, you know, he's not alone, by the way. So Kuhn's born in 1922, okay? And if you look at a lot of people of his generation, and these are people who had some background in physics. So Paul Feyerabend, you may have heard of him. He was a student of Popper's. Imre Lakatos, in the United States, we have people like Russell Hansen. I think you mentioned, you talked about him. All these people are born within 3 or 4 years of each other. They all have physics backgrounds. I mean, it's quite clear from the kind of philosophy of science they do that the physics is kind of there, available, as it were, as examples and things. But at the end of the day, they left physics. They all left physics. Okay? And a lot has to do with what happens to science after World War II. Because, you know, if you were to look at what physics... See, here's the other thing, too, I think it's worth always pointing out. Although we talk about physics as being the most advanced science from an intellectual standpoint, and I think that, you know, there's no reason to doubt that. I'm not questioning that. Nevertheless, from the standpoint of disciplines that require a lot of material resources in order to be conducted, okay, chemistry was really the field that sort of blazed the trails, okay? And this is why, if you look at the 19th century, chemistry was a science that industry was always interested in. And in fact, that led to all the great progress. And that even before World War II, physics was what we would call these days a little science subject. In other words, it was still very much a science where people were operating with chalk and blackboard, and even the experiments were still being done in reasonably sized rooms, you know, didn't require CERN or anything even close to that, right? It's only when you start to get into the particle accelerator business, and this is where it's interesting to look at, you know, when the first particle accelerator gets constructed at Berkeley with Ernesto Lawrence, right, which is a kind of prototype for the kinds of things that happened after the war, right? There's a whole big controversy about where you house this thing. Is this really an appropriate thing for academics to deal with? Because it just looks like a lot of heavy, dangerous machinery. Now, of course, physics nowadays, you know, we have CERN, which is circulating around, you know, in Switzerland and other countries as well, and it's this enormous thing. But the point was, there was no automatic connection back in those days between the size of the scientific enterprise in terms of the material resources required and the quality or the intellectual value of it, right? Because physics was seen as the premier science even in the first half of the 20th century when chemistry was soaking up most of the funds. And as you know, if you do any kind of history of science and you look at the relative hierarchy of the fields, right, after relativity, after quantum mechanics, chemistry becomes a very subordinate science from an intellectual standpoint, but it's still pulling in the money. Because it's practical, you know, it's got all these applications industrially and militarily and all the rest of it. This only happens to physics as a result of World War II. Okay? And see, this is what Kuhn's responding to. And this is what people of Kuhn's generation, these guys who are all born in the 1920s, what they're responding to. And these are the people who provide the foundation for the history and philosophy of science. Okay? Because in a sense, they feel that in a sense, when physics scaled up and became this big science idea, I mean, I don't know if you, do you talk about big science as a formal notion? I mean,
not enough. Talk about it, yeah.
You know, so there is this... It's a kind of a technical term that's due to Derek de Solla Price. Does this name mean anything to anyone? Derek de Solla? Okay. So this is a term that's, you know, that really starts to get some currency in the early 1960s, right, because of this guy, Derek de Solla Price. And Derek de Solla Price is the man who is responsible for what we nowadays call scientometrics, right, measuring the size and shape of science. So through citation counts in articles, you know, all that stuff the Science Citation Index does, Price was really the first guy to kind of see the potential of that as a kind of database on which one can start charting the way in which science is developing and perhaps even make predictions and projections about where science is going. Okay, so Derek de Solla Price. He was originally trained as a mathematician at Cambridge, he moved around throughout the world and ended his career with a chair at Yale in the United States in the history of science. But this is a guy who, in a way, more than anyone else, and he is of the same generation as Kuhn, and I think there was a period, maybe in the late 1960s, before Kuhn really shot up, that he was seen as kind of a rival to Kuhn in terms of understanding science. But he's a very important figure, because this is a guy who basically charts, in many ways, how science qualitatively changes its character as a result of the quantitative change that takes place. So when we're talking, so it's no longer just chemistry that's getting a lot of money, right? All the sciences start to get a lot of money, and after World War II, this is state funded. And why is this? Well, it's because of the Cold War, right? Where, in a sense, you end up getting a kind of proxy war taking place in the scientific arena that in the past, with regard to the first two world wars, was done on the military arena, right? I mean, I think that's a way to, you know, if you think about the funding patterns that go on with governments over the course of the second half of the 20th century, when we have the Cold War, right, it's this massification of science, all of which has something either directly or indirectly to do with defense purposes. And this includes stuff like the internet as well. Right? I mean, that's just, you know, in a way, that's the side of it that's most obvious now, but there were all kinds of other things that went on. Computer technology, you know, even the stuff with molecular biology, all this kind of stuff, right? You had the defense departments of all the various nations. And it's the first time, actually, after World War II, that you get a kind of global approach where every nation feels it needs to have a national science policy. Okay? Because that's the other thing, too, that I think is worth pointing out, is that before World War II, there were some nations, Germany, Japan, I guess they would be the main ones, that actually had ongoing nationalized science funding. And it usually was for strategic goals. It wasn't necessarily discipline-based. But what you start to have after World War II is, you know, something that is along the models of the U.S. National Science Foundation, which is similar to what we have in this country, whereby the science funding is public, is very big, it's public, but it's divided largely along disciplinary lines, where the scientists, the peer review, right, are seen as the people who, you know, decide who should get what. Now, you might say, well, this is great. And I do think that from in retrospect, despite what people sometimes say, that the Cold War was, in fact, the golden age of science funding from a national science standpoint. You went, what's the golden age of public funding of science? Answer, the Cold War. Why? Because it was in that period that you had enormous numbers of nations throughout the world thinking that science was crucial to national security. Okay? Because look, even in the periods, and you could start thinking about this from the Industrial Revolution in the early 19th century, right? There have been a lot of people who say, hey, you know, science is important for wealth production. But nobody has argued that this, you know, well, not nobody, that's not true actually, but the point is that most people believed that because rational people will realize the value of science to increasing wealth production through efficiency, through innovation, all these kinds of things, right? That there would be spontaneous private funding for science. In other words, you didn't really need the state to kind of go in there directly. Maybe the state might provide incentives, but at the end of the day, the funders would be private. And in fact, if you look at who is funding science up to the end of World War II, it is primarily private. And it's like the Rockefeller Foundation, right? Siemens Foundation in Germany, right? These are the people who are funding large-scale scientific research transnationally. It is not the states. The states only get interested in regular public science funding with the Cold War, okay? Because the science is seen as somehow crucial for national security. Now, you know, A lot of the stuff that we're still dining out on in the early 21st century comes from the Cold War. Okay? So I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but it does force you to think about science in a certain manner. Okay? So if you want to know, well, how was it that people, you know, how was it that states suddenly came to this kind of idea that they should have regular public funding for science at a pretty significant level regardless? Because the thing was that if you look at World War I and World War II, the pattern was to actually, because of, you know, a country is being threatened, you would bring all the scientists together and they would be fighting for the national interest, and then once the war is over, they'd go back to what they were doing before. In other words, there was not sustained public funding for science. There was just public funding for science because of emergency situation. And once the emergency is over, you go back to normal. But it's with the Cold War that people say you need sustained public funding of science, even if you're not being attacked, because you could be attacked at any moment. Now, why did anyone believe this was a plausible idea? Well, I do think that the precedent set by the atomic bomb becomes very important. I mean, certainly when we were kids, the atomic bomb was a big deal. I mean, maybe for you guys, you know, it doesn't matter very much. But, you know, the thing was that when that atomic bomb was detonated on Japan in 1945, okay, that changed the whole ballgame with regard to the way people thought about science. And the reason why it changed the ballgame, and I think this is something that all of these historians and philosophers of science like Kuhn and all people of his generation really picked up on very quickly, was who exactly was responsible for creating the atomic bomb? It was the theoretical physicists. Atomic bomb was not something that was just kind of concocted together by a bunch of dopey engineers who were given a kind of job specification. They were concocted by the high-level guys who actually got the Nobel Prizes for the fundamental physics on which the bomb was based. Okay? And it was for the first time, in any kind of clear way, it was demonstrated that if you actually have conceptually driven, theoretically oriented scientists in a room together for a long enough period of time, and you throw enough money at them, they will come up with something that is completely practical. Seriously, there was no clear demonstration of that point prior to that time. So, for example, you know, if you think about the early 20th century, and you look at the already you start to get by the 1920s after World War I, you start to get lots of advertisements in magazines, newspapers, and so forth, not only in America and Britain, but also Germany, all over the place, about the value of how science is transforming our everyday life, right? In terms of toasters and vacuum cleaners and refrigerators and all this kind of consumer goods, right? And typically the kind of guy who is being portrayed as the scientist who's doing something is a scientist who works for a corporation. Okay? So the original presentation in a lot of these magazine ads that you start to see in the 1920s of the guy with the white lab coat who's kind of juggling chemicals, you know, that kind of image, right, is a guy who works for DuPont, for example. He's not at Harvard, right? He's at DuPont. Okay? And that was the default position of people's understanding of where the value of science came from. Namely, you sort of imagine that you had these kind of entrepreneurs, inventors who come up with these ideas, and then you kind of mass produce them by putting them in the lab, and you hire scientists to do that, and the scientists are basically these kinds of high-tech workers. Okay? But the point is that kind of trajectory, you know, is, you know, starts with the idea that, you know, we want to do things that help us to live a better life, and therefore we get the smartest people on board to do it, and that's what we do at DuPont or General Electric or Westinghouse or any of these places that were so big in the early 20th century. What you don't have is an ad that says, let's start off by thinking about the fundamental nature of matter. Let's start off by doing a little chalk, you know, blackboard stuff where we're doing quadratic equations and bullshit like that, and you know, and you know, then let's kind of work our way down from that to something that might be recognizably practical. No, no, that's not what the ads look like. Right? It's rather, we want to do something. We got the smart guys that we can tell how to do, you know, you say, do this for us, and they just come up with their bag of tricks and produce it. Right? That's the way it was prior to World War II. That was the way in which, the last thing I would want to say is that we did not live in a scientific world prior to the end of World War II. We certainly did, okay? People were being very scientized, you know, for 150 years prior to the end of World War II, from 1800 onward. Industrial Revolution, you name it. There's science is being sold. But it's very rarely being sold to the public as something that requires that you start from first principles, that the theory actually generates the results in a very powerful way. Now, of course, the academic kind of always believed that. Newton believed it. You know, all those guys believed it. But in terms of what worked for the public, there was really never, ever any kind of clear empirical demonstration. Because after all, you think about Isaac Newton, greatest scientist who ever lived in history. What practical thing did he actually come up with? Nothing. Right? I mean, the Industrial Revolution, James Watt, all these people, you know, you think about who are these great guys from the Industrial Revolution. They're typically self-made men. Right? They're guys who are very kind of, you know, clever, clearly, and they're often in correspondence with the various professors that they need to get something from. So it's not like these guys are totally clueless or without networks. But what they certainly are not are theoretically driven scientists. Right? They're not that. Right? And in fact, you know, if you think about the way in which science and gets sold until the end of World War II, that whole self-made thing is actually seen as a positive thing. Okay? And in fact, you know, one kind of historical benchmark that might interest you is that in World War I was the first war that the United States ever entered into that was conducted outside of its shores. Okay? So it was the first time the U.S. got into some sort of global self-consciousness. And it took a lot of effort, actually. Okay, so who actually, and as you know, if you know anything about World War I, you know the U.S. came in kind of at the end. But the point is, who was the guy who was running the scientific program for the United States during World War I? It was Thomas Edison, a functional illiterate, basically. Right? No formal schooling. Very clever guy. But no formal schooling. He had a 1,000 patents under his belt, all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't just that he was not formally schooled. He was, in fact, hostile to academics. And the interesting thing about reading the kind of discussion that went on behind the way in which science was informing the American effort in World War I is the extent to which nobody really questioned this. Right, so in other words, you know, Thomas Edison gave a very famous press conference when he was made President Wilson made Edison the head science honcho for World War I. Edison, you know, electric light bulb, the phonograph, you know, the guy was, you know, he's a very important inventor. And he said, and so he was asked, how many academic scientists are you going to have on this, you know, war council that's going to be producing science for the military? And he said, well, we might need some people who can do mathematics. Right, because Edison wasn't good with numbers. Okay, he was a kind of hands-on guy. If you know anything, I don't know if you ever studied Thomas Edison, this is Mr. Trial and Error, right? This is a guy who just like, you know, and he's, you know, he, indeed, you know, right, the idea is that invention is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. That's Edison. And so he's a totally anti-intellectual guy. Okay? And so he thought that really from the standpoint of what we need of academics to produce a, you know, satisfactory war effort from science is we need guys who can do equations. We don't need science for thinking. Thinking comes from the imagination, right? The genius. It doesn't come from science per se. He understands science is a very technical thing. Okay? And I stress all this to you because it's only after World War II that you get a public shift on this matter. Because nobody's questioning what Edson's saying, okay? And if you were to go to universities throughout the world, America, Britain, anywhere, and you look at what academics are doing until the end of World War II, they are primarily teaching. They are not researchers. In fact, one of the things that's very interesting, looking at the Rockefeller Foundation and all these other private organizations, is the way in which they set up incentive structures to pull people away from teaching to do research, and they succeed because these people, when they're hired as academics at universities, even at Harvard University, they are hired primarily to teach. Okay? They are not hired to do original research. This is only something that happens after World War II. And this is, to a large extent, due to the understanding of what the atomic bomb project was about. Okay? You know, where you have all these Nobel Prize winning physicists, all these intellectual dudes, and boy oh boy, they deliver the goods. Boy oh boy, can they deliver the goods, right? And so then this sets a precedent. Now you might think, I know, some of you might be thinking, well, you know, the atomic bomb, you know, is that really a precedent, you know, that we want to kind of live up to? Trust me, it is. It is, because of the massive amount, because look, here's the thing about the atomic bomb project, and if you want to read more about this, you know, there's this guy who was the vice president of MIT, which is the American version of this place, Vannevar Bush. Okay, he is the most important intellectual with regard to American science policy in the second half of the 20th century. The endless frontier, right? And this is basically an argument for public funding of science, regardless. Peacetime, wartime, just we need to have the public funding science, and we need to have the public funding science at its most fundamental levels, not just, you know, funding science because we think that if we got a few chemists on board, we'll be able to make more products that'll boost the economy. No, that's Mickey Mouse stuff for Vannevar Bush. He's talking about the long-term state of the human condition, ensuring our borders, national security, you know, resisting all kinds of threats. He's thinking the big picture. And it's quite clearly a physics-led picture. Okay? So Vannevar Bush is the one who really puts this kind of view on the map, which ends up creating a kind of default standing for public funding of science. So here we are now, right in the beginning of the 21st century, and when public funding of science is being withdrawn, people complain. People think, oh my God, the private sector is going to take it over, blah, 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 blah. Yes, that may happen, but the point is, you should understand, that is in fact normal historically, the private sector funds science. Okay? I mean, so the point is that prior to the end of World War II, when people suddenly realized, my God, having theoretically oriented science might actually, you know, save us from any kind of external threat, that's the only time that publicly funded science actually got the votes in Congress. You see, and with the end of the Cold War, 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union, all this kind of stuff, right? Then all those intuitions start to disappear. Right? And then things open up and you start to see a real change happening. You know, and the change happens at many different levels. So, for example, physics starts losing its significance as the premier science. Okay? One thing you may not know, maybe you've mentioned it in talking about Kuhn, but the kind of the figure who was responsible for ushering Kuhn from being this kind of failed physicist, which it looked like he was going to become, into being this premier historian, philosopher of science, was the president of Harvard, James Bryant Conant. I don't know if you, did you mention him? Okay. So James Bryant Conant is a chemist by training, and first natural scientist to be president of Harvard University, perhaps the last natural scientist to be president of Harvard University as well. There hasn't been one since, I don't believe. They usually are lawyers, historians, people like that, right? And if you consider the previous president of Harvard University was a theologian, you know, this is quite a significant thing. Well, Conant was an incredibly influential man, okay? He was a chum of Vannevar Bush, and in World War II, Conant was the one who was the go-between between the president, first Roosevelt, then Truman, and the guys working at Los Alamos creating the atomic bomb, right, in the United States. So he was the main administrator, okay? And he was, and you know, there are lots of reports about these things, they're all about, but there seems to be a consensus that he was one of the people who very strongly convinced Truman to drop the bomb, right? That this would end the war, and you know, so he was really, you know, and then he became the first American ambassador to West Germany after World War II. But one of the things that he realized, I mean, so this is a guy who I think knew exactly what he was doing. Kuhn is a bit of a clueless wonder, actually, because Kuhn is someone who's obviously disaffected by all these changes happening to science and the war and all this, but he doesn't quite get it all together. But luckily he's got a very smart guy who's supporting him, Conant, who sees exactly how the wind's blowing and which way the world is turning. Okay? And so one of the things that Conant did, and this is the thing that actually enabled Kuhn to have the amount of time to be able to make the transition from being a physicist to being a historian and philosopher, was he created these general education in science courses after World War II, 1946. Okay? And this is really important, you know, from a standpoint of, you know, where science communication comes from and all this, because Conant realized that after World War II, dropping the atomic bomb, people would be impressed. But being impressed could mean two things. You could either be, oh, wow, this is amazing. Now imagine if human beings actually use this knowledge for some good, you know? Or they could say, shit, they're going to do this again. Right, but the point was that, you know, so the atomic bomb is impressive, and so people no longer had to be convinced that public funding for science was a good idea. The question is, how should they be thinking about it? Right, and Conant was very concerned that in light of the precedent set by the atomic bomb, that the public would become too defensive, in the sense that would want to restrict things, would want to curtail things too much, and wouldn't allow free inquiry to take place. So the point of the general education in science courses that Conant implements while president of Harvard University is, first of all, it's basically aimed at people without science backgrounds, but who may nevertheless, being alumni of Harvard University, be in rather powerful positions to influence the course of science as policymakers, politicians, whatever, right? And so it becomes important that those people have the right frame of mind for making decisions about science. And in particular, he's worried about science, you know, about people thinking, my God, if we allow this rather innovative, adventurous research to happen, right, then we might get another bomb or a bigger bomb. And if you know anything about the way these discussions went about nuclear arms in the 1950s, you know, the hydrogen bomb, there were all these kind of things going on. People were getting very, very, very worried. But Conant thought, no, we can't really train people to be focusing on the fear. People have to focus on the promise. And how are people going to focus on the promise? Well, you have to basically present science, regardless of all the impact and regardless of all the influence that science has. Science, at the end of the day, is an autonomous activity. And if you're really a scientist, you are working on very specific problems, and you have a certain kind of intellectual integrity that comes from operating under what Kuhn would eventually call a paradigm, and that actually keeps you on the straight and narrow, so that you actually know the difference. By virtue of your training as a scientist, you know the difference between doing good science and some kind of application which may or may not be good from the standpoint of larger external goals. Okay? This is a point that comes across very clearly in the Conant program. And Kuhn, of course, buys into it. All right? Now the difference between Conant and Kuhn is very little, actually, except that Conant believed that Conant didn't have this kind of collective notion of paradigm that Kuhn had, right? Because if you think about Kuhn's paradigm, right, that Kuhn believes that not only are you trained to do science in a way in which other scientists recognize as scientific, but that apprenticeship that you have early on actually gives you a worldview, gives you a kind of mindset, and so that there's a sense in which the scientists all think the same way. And this is why the whole business of, you know, anomalies and crisis and revolution, if you follow the Kuhn story, why that's so important in Kuhn's story doesn't appear in Conant. Okay? Conant actually believed that the scientific ethic was a personal ethic. Okay? And so, in other words, it's, you know, there was a sense in which, by virtue of being trained as a scientist, you know, that there's a kind of higher moral standard of integrity than perhaps you might expect of other people. But not any other people, because you might compare it to the integrity of a doctor, the integrity of a lawyer, right? All of these people operate as individual professionals, and yet we trust them, and, you know, we imagine that they have some very clear sense of boundaries of what's appropriate and inappropriate. Of course, that's not always true, but we sort of imagine that to be the case. Okay, and I think that's kind of where Conant was coming from. And if you read somebody like Max Weber, are you familiar with the sociologist Max Weber? A very important figure in my field. He wrote this. He delivered this very famous lecture toward the end of his career, 1919, called "Science as a Vocation." And this idea of vocation, which you may have heard about, the thing you got to pick up: vocation literally is the calling from God. Right, voca is call from Latin, right? And so the idea was that it was an individual calling. And if you really, you know, and this then imposes a certain kind of discipline and ethic individually. And the reason why the individual side of it was stressed so much by people like Weber and also Conant was because of the idea that scientists very often need to buck against the establishment. Right, they need to kind of say, well, look, the evidence says this. You may believe this, but the evidence says this. You know, in other words, you may actually have to go against conventional wisdom, established authority, right? Because the idea of the vocation is one that within Christianity only becomes popularized with Martin Luther. Right, so Weber is invoking Martin Luther. As you know, Martin Luther is the founder of the Protestant Reformation, which is when, you know, Christianity officially splits off from the Roman Catholic Church and the Vatican and the Pope and all that kind of stuff, okay? And so Weber is basically saying that the scientist, as it were, has this kind of individual ethic that will, you know, ensure that it doesn't just do what everybody else wants. Kuhn is different, right? Because Kuhn actually does believe that there is this kind of collective mind to science. Right? And that guys, you know, so if you think about the history of science, right? When we try to present scientists in their most positive, progressive kind of light, we often come up with guys like Galileo. Galileo bucks the system. He goes against the church, right? All that sort of stuff. It's all true. But the thing is that from the standpoint of somebody like Kuhn, he is very much an outlier. He is not a normal scientist, right? He is not a normal scientist. Conant would actually want would want people to think of Galileo as a significant scientist that they should be paying attention to. But Kuhn, no. Galileo is not a normal scientist, and this is why the whole Kuhn thing with the anomalies and the crisis, right? So in other words, no paradigm shifts before its time. In other words, it's not a matter of a scientist suddenly coming on board and saying, hey, you guys, you believed all this, you think the evidence is all in your favor, now I'm going to give you a totally different point of view. That doesn't work in science, right? This is what Kuhn says. And so guys like Galileo, and so, you know, you think about what is the lesson of Galileo exactly. Certainly within his own lifetime, Galileo was defeated. Right, he was under house arrest. He spent his remaining days under house arrest. you know, people listened to him, paid attention to him, but it really took another 50 years or more before people actually were able to come up with the arguments and the evidence and so forth that we now take to be foundational of this kind of modern shift in the scientific worldview. Okay, and so Newton, for example, if you look at the difference between what Newton has to say about laws of motion and inertia and gravity and all this kind of stuff, and compare that to what Galileo says, Newton's light years ahead of Galileo, right? Galileo's just gesturing at things that Newton actually, you know, sorted out in mathematical terms. And, you know, Kuhn's position here is basically, and so should it be, right? In other words, that science is this kind of collective thought process, this paradigm, right, that needs to protect itself, and it's something that's a collective protective thing. And so this is where science can very, you know, for Kuhn, science is not only a collective activity that doesn't just take whatever some radical individual says is given, but it's also a collective activity that has very clear boundaries from influence outside of itself. Right? So one of the things that I think, you know, you should draw from reading somebody like Kuhn, right, is that science is an autonomous activity. Because if you look at Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions, there's very little, you learn very little about what's actually happening historically during the periods in which science is undergoing whatever changes he's talking about. Okay? And in fact, that's a very important feature about the way in which science is defined by Kuhn. You know, so for example, Kuhn stops talking about chemistry after 1850. He's primarily talking about physics, and even with physics, he stops after about the 1920s. And it isn't because he's ignorant of these sciences. He's actually got a PhD in these things, right? But rather, what he starts to believe, what he believes, is that all of these sciences, after a certain point, no longer are dictating their own research agendas, but rather are being in some way co-opted or determined by outside forces, whether they are public or private. So in the case of chemistry, of course, I think it's quite easy to see that, you know, industrial co-optation of the development of chemistry in the middle to late 19th century, that's pretty clear. And then this happens with physics, not through industrial co-optation, but more through military, state-oriented co-optation that happens with World War II. And this is why Kuhn left physics. Okay? So in other words, if you want to understand Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions from the standpoint of Kuhn's own biography as someone who began in science, he is engaged in some kind of nostalgia trip. Right? You know, a nostalgia trip that he presents as the ideal world. The ideal world being the world in which the science is able to develop in its own way, on its own terms, and is not unduly influenced by external factors, whether they come from the private or public sector. Okay? And this is why Kuhn refused ever to comment on the way in which science had developed, well, basically after the time in which he wrote his book. So Kuhn's book is written in 1962. Kuhn lived until 1996. He got interviewed a lot. He would never talk about the science of his day. Okay? And my guess is the reason why he didn't do that was he believed that the science of his day was very severely compromised and no longer conformed to his model. Okay? Because science was now being driven by factors other than those set by the scientific community itself. Okay? So, the point here being that you end up getting, over the course of the 20th century, you get a lot of people who, in a way, began by thinking about science as delivering on the promises of philosophy. You know, what is the nature of matter? What is the nature of things? You know, you go back to the ancient Greeks and you think about when we talk about the origins of Western philosophy and all those questions those Greeks were posing, right, to a large extent, those are questions that we now interpret naturally as scientific questions. Okay? And that was pretty clear, I think, for a lot of these guys, logical positivists, Popper's students, Kuhn, people of Kuhn's generation, all these people, I think, kind of got that, right? So in other words, they saw science in some way providing some kind of, you know, empirically addressing, if not solving, the fundamental problems of philosophy. And that's why physics seemed like such an attractive discipline, in fact. But then if you actually look at the way in which science gets implicated in the political process over the course of the 20th century, especially after World War II, then you got a different story. Then, you know, it looks like science is being co-opted. It looks like science is being compromised. It's being kind of driven by things outside of these kind of fundamental questions about understanding the nature of reality. And so in this context, somebody like Vannevar Bush or Conant, these sort of people are trying to square the circle, because they're basically arguing that you should let the scientists pursue things wherever they go, because you know in the long term there will be some practical payoff that will be of benefit to humanity. And what's our case? Our case is the atomic bomb. The physics for the atomic bomb is developed in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. By the time we get to the fourth decade of the 20th century, we've got a bomb. Right? And then afterwards, of course, we get nuclear energy, we get all the and nuclear energy stuff had been talked about before the bomb, actually. So the point is, all of these things then come downstream. But you need the basic science first. Okay? I don't know how much you study science policy, but in the science policy jargon, this kind of picture, you know, where Bush and Conant and so forth are giving these arguments for why there should be public support for science, is called talk about the linear model, right? Where if you got the science up front, then the technology will follow eventually. Right? It's called the linear model. This is where it comes from. Right? The atomic bomb project is the model. So you know, I'll conclude here, but the point is that, you know, if you want to look, you know, this business with the atomic bomb, again, I don't know if the atomic bomb really bothers you very much. Maybe not, I don't know. But the point is that it really had a lot of significance with regard to how we think about science. Because it's only with the atomic bomb that the idea of the basic science, the theoretical science, driving something very practical really becomes publicly available. But at the same time, it is also the thing that probably leads a lot of the people from Kuhn's generation, including Kuhn himself, to move away from the science, because they don't want to be part of that trajectory.
So Steve, how then should we interpret the role of the science communicator? And what should we think about science?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think if you look at all these guys, like the positivist, Popper, Kuhn, all the rest of them, right, they've got a certain kind of ideal that they want to keep alive for why they were attracted to science in the first place. Right? I talked about it as nostalgia. That's a bit denigrating. But the point about nostalgia, right, is that you have this kind of image, the thing you really like, the thing you'd like to go back to. Right? I think most of the normative ideals of science have that kind of character to them, where there is some moment in the past when things were going fine, where science was really being what it was supposed to be. I mean, this is why we continue to talk about the scientific revolution. Right? We keep on talking about Galileo and Newton and all these guys like 500 years ago, right? But we keep on talking about them, Copernicus, right? Why? Why? It's not because we're idiots, right? But it's because in some sense, the way science functions, you know, the kind of thing you can show about science, right, is kind of what you'd like science to be showing today. But unfortunately, it may not be able to show it quite so clearly, because the science is so closely integrated with the way in which our societies are reproduced. Right? Science doesn't stand outside of society as challenging society, but rather science is part of the way by which the society maintains itself. You see, and that's, I think, the real problem, right? And all these guys, whether we're talking about Kuhn, Popper, or the positivists, they all, in a sense, step back from that. They weren't going to be part of that story. So they end up presenting these rather idealized views of science as a way of protecting that against the way in which science is actually operating today. Now, you see, in the environment we're living in, you see, because we're beyond the Cold War, and now we're in this position where things are getting reprivatized, right? And so we have this sort of market environment for science. And frankly, all of these guys that I've been talking about aren't much help in any of this. Because these guys never kind of you know, in a sense, I think the trajectory that the, you know, science begins private, then it becomes this public thing that becomes the basis for national security and the way in which we rationalize society, and then just sort of continues that way. I think that was kind of the way people thought about stuff when we were kids, okay? But I think the end of the Cold War changes the whole story, and now this whole business of marketization of science. And of course, the ascendancy of the biomedical sciences illustrates this, right? So now if you want to talk, you know, anybody who wants to do history and philosophy of science, you know, what science should they focus on? Not physics, but biology. Now, why is that? Really? Well, because biology is a very marketized science, right? I mean, biology is a science that's pulled in many different directions, where there isn't the pretense of unity that there was with physics. Because the thing about physics, and you still see this in the rhetoric of guys like Stephen Hawking and all these kind of old school guys, right? We're trying to get into the mind of God. We're trying to come up with a grand unified theory of everything, right? Physics, in a way, has its own mission quite independently of whatever you want to use physics for. That's still there. It doesn't sell very much, but it's still there. And it brings tears to people's eyes as a nostalgia.
You've got CERN, you've got Higgs boson, the God particle.
Sure, exactly. But do you know the amount of hype? I mean, the point is, had that thing failed, that would be the end of physics. I mean, the amount of hype that was surrounding that. No, because there's not... I mean, physics is a real hard sell. They need stuff like that, right? Because if you look at the biomedical sciences, okay, anyone who's been involved with it knows that, in fact, there's an enormous amount of failure in those fields. But those fields are being very heavily promoted because people already have a kind of belief that this is the kind of science that will deliver stuff that will help people's lives. And that's a really different conception of science from what I've been talking about in this lecture, right? Because that's a science that's very consumer-driven. And by the way, don't fool yourselves, it's not every branch of biology that's benefiting from this, because all of this kind of, you know, paleontology, ecology, you know, all that Darwin stuff, that stuff doesn't get a lot of money. No, what gets money is the stuff, you know, you do the genetic scans, you come up with the drugs, you try them out, that's what gets money, okay? And so those fields are just, you know, blossoming, okay? But it's very much market-driven, you see? And if you start with a conception that says, well, science doesn't have to be this unified thing. Science can be moving in many different directions. It's pluralistic, it's diverse, it's blah, 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 heterogeneous. Use all your favorite postmodern terms. Then you're ready for capitalism. Right? You're ready, because you've got, you know, markets are about niche differentiation. You see, and so you can even start to blend the discussion of evolution and the discussion of markets. The same language. Okay? And so this is the world we live in. Now, if you look at any of these guys I've been talking about for the last hour, you know, positivist Popper, Kuhn, they weren't part of that universe at all. Biology is not in Kuhn's book. Okay? You know? I mean, if you look at what the positivists and Popper had to say about biology, they had a soft spot for Lamarck. Okay? These are not guys who, you know, in a way, really thought that, you know, the whole Darwinian, you know, this whole idea was going to be really the big thing in science. They really were imagining a unified science. At least one that was physics-led. But we don't live in this world. And I think this is the real challenge for the science communication people. Because look, you got two views of science on the table. One view is the old view that doesn't fit, but nevertheless has a nostalgic value, which is this unified view of science, right? Which is a physics-led view, where we're trying to find out the ultimate secrets of the universe and the mind of God and all that kind of stuff. Right? I mean, that we've got that, and most of the philosophy actually is about that when it gets right down to it, and so we can keep on talking about Galileo and Newton till the cows come home. But then on the other hand, we have science that's actually conducted now, which is much more market phenomenon, and so if you look at the way in which biology has kind of unfolded over the last 25 years, you'll see the diversity, you'll see the variation, right? Where certain branches of biology are really heavily promoted, perhaps beyond their intellectual merit, and other branches of biology just are dying because they don't have any funding. Okay? Now that's the world we live in science. And so the question that, you know, as a science communicator is, do you justify this? Do you oppose this? What do you make of this? But I think the thing that is clear is that the biology-based model is nowadays seen as kind of the default model of science, right? That in some sense, I think people do believe that science needs to justify itself in a very direct kind of way. And I think, see, you guys who are going to go into science communication, you guys are on the front line of this. And you can either just cater to this, where you say, well, yes, I'm going to, you know, I got this science, I'm going to sell it the best way I can, and best way means as immediately as I can. So I'm going to foreground the short-term benefits. But this is not science anymore when you do that. Because the whole point about science is you're actually not just committing, as it were, to producing particular kinds of products that'll make people's lives better in the immediate future, but rather you're committing to a project, right, that has a kind of life of its own independently of its outcomes in the short term. And this is what Popper was all about, right? That science is about actually pushing the frontiers of our knowledge and pushing the frontiers of our being as well. And that means you have to have a support system that allows you to make mistakes and to be able to survive in the back of those mistakes. You see? I mean, one of the things that I would say about public funding of science, especially when we talk about national security issues back in the Cold War, was, and again, I don't know how you guys think about the Cold War, whether it was a good thing or bad thing, but one of the good things about the Cold War was it was all about long-term thinking. It was very anti-market, right? It was about anticipating the threat that might be posed by the aggressor in the future. So you're always thinking a step ahead. And that motivation, however paranoid that might seem, nevertheless always was raising your intellectual game. Okay? And the problem with the kind of world we live in with regard to science is that we're always thinking in terms of, okay, we're doing this stuff in the lab, how are we going to sell it? Right, where the future relies exclusively on our ability to sell the stuff that we've already got. I mean, if you look at the way pharmaceutical companies, they're pulling out of R&D. There's a sort of sociological phenomenon that's really appalling, and you may already know it, but it's worth pointing out. Namely, in the period, the first decade or so after the end of the Cold War, when the pharmaceutical industries really start to mushroom in a big way and became the kind of vanguard of scientific research, they had these enormous R&D divisions in their companies. And then when stuff didn't sell on the back of what they were doing, right, then they started divesting their R&D divisions. And so what they do now is they hire university people. Right? So they outsource their R&D to universities, and universities, being desperate for income, contract with them, right, often end up the companies get the better end of the deal because the university guys aren't being paid as much as the old corporate guys in R&D were being paid. And so this is kind of what's been happening, right? So the idea being that corporations, yeah, they step up to the plate for a few years, but if they don't get profits on the basis of the amount of R&D they put in, they just pull out. And if there's going to be any R&D, it's going to be done by bringing the academics in. And then that skews the academic research agenda.
Steve,
okay, sorry.
We've got lots of meetings in 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
So Steve's going to stay for a drink, so we could probably best take questions downstairs in the
ocean. Yeah, I'm sorry to have gone on so long, but I do think this is, for you guys who are going to be living in the future, this is an important thing, because we're in a totally different world from the world in which all these people I was talking about were in.
So Steve's here to bring us up to date and to remind us of just how complicated, in terms of values, being a science communicator is. So thank you very much, and
thank you.
Carry on in a bar. Thank you.